Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can be understood about a relationship and the people in it only after it has come to an end? Memoirist Alexandra Fuller was just 22 years old when she met the man she would marry a year later. Raised in southern Africa by British immigrant farmers, Fuller's childhood was marked by life and death dangers, both from civil war and the environment, and it was shaped by her parents' assumption that chaos was preferable to convention. As she writes in her new book, she was attracted to her now ex-husband precisely because of his stability, calm, and apparent wholeness. But the stark contrasts that bound them together at first were strong enough eventually to pull them apart. The new memoir by Alexandra Fuller is called Leaving Before the Rains Come. Alexandra, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You write that your ex-husband, Charlie, shared none of your brokenness. Before you met him, did it occur to you that you were looking for somebody who felt like a savior?
No, I mean, in real time, you don't experience yourself the way you do, you know, after the fact, which I suppose is one of the difficult things about even speaking about a memoir. I mean, you're transformed by the act of living through the things that you've lived through, and then you're again transformed by the act of writing it. I mean, after all, one is trying to create you know, a coherent work of literature, not therapy. So you do that in private. But, you know, what ends up happening is a kind of coherence, maybe a sort of wisdom, a kind of, you know, retrospective 2020 vision that you obviously don't have at the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting because obviously writing about a relationship after it ends provides you with all this great perspective. But what are the challenges after things get acrimonious in the way that they do at the end of a marriage of calling to mind and explaining to readers the moments when you both were truly in love?
Well, you know, that wasn't difficult for me. I mean, the way that I've ended up speaking about this book is it's, you know, the anti-divorce divorce-moi. Because it really isn't, for me, about the breakup. I mean, that was the saddest decision I've ever made in my life. So to look, and yes, of course, things got acrimonious. I mean, divorces are messy and so on. But that was not what I certainly didn't want to spend my time or my energy there. And I think that's the sort of thing best left to the therapist. But it was easy for me to remember that kind of giddy, wonderful moment of falling in love. And in a lot of ways, that, you know, that was fun to recreate in these pages because it was incredibly romantic when I met Charlie. You know, we were young. We were in Zambia. He was Mr. Adventure. You know, I had grown up with this, you know, my father is called the John Wayne of Zambia, but he would give John Wayne a run for his money. And, you know, in this glamorous sort of gun-toting, brandy-drinking mother. So it, you know, we had all the elements of romance right at our fingertips. And just as a sheer writer, I mean, let alone living it, it was so much fun.
I was thinking about the scientific research that exists now that says that if, like, your first date is particularly exciting, you're more likely to end up bonded to someone. And it seems like a neuroscientist could have written your first date, the early part of your relationship, word for word.
I haven't heard of that research. But, yeah, I actually now don't think that Charlie has a very strong accent, but when I first met him, he had such a thick US accent. But, you know, I barely understood. I thought he was asking me out for a cup of coffee. It turned out we were going canoeing for a week, and which I was terrified. I mean, no Zambian in their right mind on purpose gets in a canoe and goes down the Zambezi River unless, you know, you're a fisherman and it's your living. You don't do it for fun. So our first date, we canoed down the Zambezi River below the wall. Charlie was a river guide back then, so he was completely comfortable. I was absolutely out of my element. I didn't really know how to paddle. I was so terrified about hippos. So I was incredibly relieved when we pulled over for lunch. I thought, you know, solid ground, phew. And then Charlie, being, you know, Mr. Adventure, suggested that we go for a hike, which was insane for all sorts of reasons, because it was noon and only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. And, you know, we were in the Zambezi Valley. The place is riddled with wildlife. But I didn't want to sound like a wimp. You know, I wanted to be game on this date. So I followed him on a hike, and we actually did end up getting charged by a she-elephant. And I scampered. It was a false charge, but, you know, I wasn't sort of looking too closely. I scampered up an anthill. And to my sort of delight, horror combined, Charlie stood his ground. And the elephant, as they're supposed to do if it's just a muck charge, she slammed to a stop in front of him, and dust was kicked up, and they sort of looked at each other for a minute and then both went their own way. And I thought, okay, if he can stand down a charging she-elephant, I should be easy.
And you had these almost superstitious ideas of why he must be the perfect man for you based on that and some other things. And that sounds to me so much like the moments that you're falling in love, right? You want to find every sort of star-guided reason why this is the person for you.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, you hear that in, I mean, again, the great thing about sort of rewriting your life is you find there is this fairy tale trope and this wonderful way to structure story around the way, you know, that love is sort of fed to us, I suppose. And I think most people have a one-sentence reason why they decided this was it. Because honestly, it's an insane contract. I mean, where and when else in your life do you say to someone who you've known for, you know, 6 months, even if it's a year, yes, I will absolutely spend the rest of my life with you and I will love you as much as I love you right now until that moment? I mean, you would never make a contract like that with a, you know, bank or a business or a job even. I mean, You're not going to, at a job interview, say, yep, that's it. And you know what? You can keep my pay at the level it is right now. It all looks good.
Well, falling in love is also, on the one hand, this amazing process of discovery about this other person, but it also involves a kind of editing, right? Consciously or unconsciously, we focus on the qualities that we really love, and then we don't shine a lot of light on the things that might be red flags for either one of us in the long term.
Well, and they say, of course, right, that the red flag is that there's always a red flag on the first date as well. And mine was that kind of deep, steady silence with which he met the charging elephant. And that deep, steady silence was what really characterized his side of the marriage. And so, although it was, you know, a lot of what I think happened to us, and maybe this is true of a lot of people who marry, you know, in times of war or in times of crisis or in sort of extreme situations, the situation itself lends all the context that you need for the relationship. And then you just get to be this partnership that survives in that. When you come to a country like the U.S., if you're, you know, middle class as we are, and you aren't fighting with a lot of the things that plenty of this country is fighting with, you know, then the focus and the sort of magnifying glass can come onto the relationship.
Why did he fall in love with you? Not that someone wouldn't, but you know what I'm saying.
I was going to say, I think that I represented for him, you know, he was an adventurer. That's what he had done until that point. And he had traveled the world. And I was exotic and young and Southern African. And I think that what I represented was a chance for him to bring that home to the U.S., you know, so that he didn't feel like that entire piece of his life had been sort of, you know, just something that he had done. I mean, in other words, it was something that stayed with him. And then I think where that was where it became really hard for him was, I have a very good friend who said, you know, Charlie went to Southern Africa and brought back this exotic plant, but then the exotic plant went feral, refused to stay in its little pot. You know, and that is the thing, isn't it? Is that you can fall in love with someone, but that isn't static. Neither your feeling about them, nor they should. I mean, they shouldn't remain static.
We're speaking with author Alexandra Fuller about her new memoir, Leaving Before the Rains Come. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Alexandra Fuller. Her new memoir is called Leaving Before the Rains Come. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Alexandra, this book at its heart seems to be as much about your identity as anything else. Does it strike you that way?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that, again, I mean, this is all I can see from a great distance, but one of the great gifts of growing up the way I did, where I did, when I did, was I was sort of dispossessed in a minor kind of way, you know, before I really understood what that meant. I want to emphasize that, you know, I am white, and that the color of my skin has always been clear to me, has given me unearned privilege. That's just that, you know. And I think that it's very important that we remember when we, you know, write a memoir or sort of speak about the experience of voice and speak about the experience of freedom of voice and freedom of movement and things, big things like being dispossessed, that I also remember that, yes, these things happened, on top of which there was just this veneer of privilege, which I was born with. That was nothing I worked toward. But that being said, I think that I have this kind of, and, you know, I got a very good education, again, through no sort of merit of my own, but just because I had white skin in Southern Africa at a time when education privileged whites, not people of color. And yet I didn't belong. I never really, I mean, I felt very Zimbabwean. I felt like I belonged to this country. I felt like, you know, after that Zambia was the country I never wanted to leave. And yet when I was 18 years old, the horrible, shocking surprise was that my parents had not gotten me a Zambian passport. I was British and I didn't feel remotely English. And so, you know, I think from a very early age, there was always the sense that, you know, I was searching for who I was. Okay, if I'm not Southern African and I'm not British, am I my passport? Am I my skin color? Am I my accent? Am I my politics? Am I the person I married? You know, because I gave up my name. I took on Charlie's name. And so, yes, this is very much a story of identity and, really, in a way, kind of coming full circle from, you know, maybe belonging nowhere to begin with and realizing at the end, that's okay. It's okay not to belong. And in fact, I would argue that for a writer, particularly a writer of nonfiction, it's essential that you court eviction from any tribe that would claim you.
So that is your identity, the not quite belonging anywhere completely.
If you need to give me one, sure.
So I want to talk about this because, you know, things were not going well in the marriage after, you know, a number of years together. You all had two kids. You were both aware that things were not what you had expected. But like a lot of couples, you sort of kept at it for maybe longer than turned out to be productive. What do you think caused you to continue trying?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with this idea that we really end the education of our sort of spiritual, emotional selves at the moment that you managed to get married? I mean, my father literally, I think, dusted his hands at the end of the aisle. Literally, it's your problem. And my mother sort of said, thank goodness we gave you elocution lessons. Americans are very taken in by a good accent. It was like she had sold someone a faulty horse and was just relieved to walk away from it. They hadn't noticed it only had three legs, sort of thing. So I think that what, and then really the only news that we get in terms of how to be in relationship is this idea that it's very hard work. We don't really get, cultural support and societal support that says, yeah, it shouldn't just be hard work, though. You know, if there's no joy, if there's no chance for the individuals to grow spiritually, if your relationship begins to feel more and more as if you are two people in solitary confinement, you know, and you've done all the quote-unquote work that you can to get out of it, out of that stalemate, maybe it is best that, you know, you break apart. And it should be difficult. I mean, especially, I think, when children are involved, which is why, you know, we stayed at it for so long. We, you know, had two children and then three. And I think you're always hoping that that magical, inexplicable spark that drew you together will somewhere, somehow reignite you. And then there is a point at which I think somebody has to have the courage to say, our silence has become a kind of violence toward each other. And, you know, we're two people waiting out a life together.
It is a novel-worthy detail in this memoir that on the day you got married, you were almost delirious with fever.
I know. My mother said, well, in retrospect, I guess that sort of glassy, fevered look was just the fact that you had a temperature of 104. Nothing to do with being deliriously in love. And again, you know, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. We married in the cold season in Zambia, and it's very common to get malaria when the, you know, that cold weather hits. I think you're sort of immune system takes a bit of shaking up. But yes, you know, looking back, it was, you know, novel worthy, I guess you could say.
And it's almost, I mean, it serves as a sort of a bit of foreshadowing, I suppose. And the very end of your relationship was marked by this terrible accident that for a time really changed the dynamics of even your, not just your relationship to Charlie, but your relationship to the act of leaving.
Well, right. So we, I think, were sort of in that moment where we realized that the end of our marriage was, you know, coming. And I was, I think, probably being more Southern African about these things, was just ready to say, right, done, you know, finished over. But Charlie really wanted to talk about it more and more and more. And we decided to go out on horses, on our horses, to sort of have the final discussion, which, you know, looking back, was kind of insane on all sorts of levels. And Charlie ended up having this near-fatal accident. And what it made me realize absolutely deeply and kind of gave me, I think, the impetus to really then move on was I had, for a few years, harbored this sense that our relationship had become so quietly violent. I mean, we did not speak to one another. It was, I write somewhere, it was as if we were two tiny, you know, most favored nations, and we had made some sort of economic treaty with each other and a grocery list relationship. You know, we got the logistics done, but we couldn't see one another anymore, and we could certainly no longer hear one another. And there was very little humor, very little joy, very little to sustain either of us in that. And it had begun to feel like a kind of violence to me, like a kind of soul death. And then when it physically manifested, that this had happened, I had no doubt whatsoever that this relationship needed to end, that there was, you know, if that Charlie was going to survive this accident, he deserved a full life. He didn't deserve a life of solitary confinement in a straitjacket. That, you know, if one of you is feeling that way, there's no such thing as just a prisoner. You know, a prison guard also is doing time. And that is how it had begun to feel.
Reading about your parents, I'm impressed by, I mean, they have a very unusual relationship, but I'm impressed by the fact that while they don't seem to be perfect, they don't even seem always to be perfect for one another, they seem to have no instinct whatsoever to change the other person.
And I think that is really the key. I mean, they've been married 50 years now, and they take no real sort of blame for the other person, but inordinate pride in one another, and sort of cheer on each other's eccentricities. It's as if they've decided to be thoroughly entertained by one another and by one another's foibles. And it really is a decision. And there really is nothing more relieving than, you know, your mother does the awful thing that she always does for the 100th time that week. In an ordinary relationship after 50 years, the appropriate response is to sigh and roll your eyes and I don't know what else. And instead, my father chuckles at her, and then my mother shrieks with laughter at herself. And the moment's gone. It's dissipated. They're back to laughing at each other. And I think that was really, looking back, what gave us so much resilience as a family was our sense of humor. We disagree thoroughly about so much, and yet there's this real instinct for humor in the family.
So the loss of that, or the absence of that in your marriage, I mean, did you look around to like other couples that you knew that you, you know, socialized with and hope that you could see someone else surviving with this, with a similar sort of lack of humor?
Yeah, everyone. Yeah. I just thought, oh no, this is the way it's done. And it really, you know, that's in a way what kind of also kept me in it. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine, you know, about 2 years before Charlie and I finally split up. And I said, okay, look, is everybody being honest about their marriage? You know, people sort of have this knee jerk, I love my wife to death, but. And I said that all I can hear is the death but bit. I can't, you know, it seems. And anyway, this person insisted, no. His spouse was his best friend and they really were crazily in love. And sure enough, almost the week that we divorced, they also were. And so I thought, you know, one of the things I'm sort of accused of or praised for, whichever way you want to look at it, in my memoirs is for being brutally honest, you know, in my first book and probably in this one, I don't know. And what it really made me realize is how much everybody else is just lying between their teeth. And I think the job of the memoirist is to, you know, take the journey to the interior and come back with what is found there. Now, this doesn't have to be your journey. It's not everyone's journey. It's just a journey. But that is your job. Your job isn't to be an anesthesiologist and sort of put everyone to sleep. Your job is to say, I went there. I found these shocking things. This is what I came back with. I'm awake. I'm alive. This is my story. If this resonates with you, great. If it doesn't, maybe figure out why. If it irritates you, perhaps even look at that.
My guest is author Alexandra Fuller. We're talking about her new memoir, Leaving Before the Rains Come. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with memoirist Alexandra Fuller about her new book, Leaving Before the Rains Come. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. When you talk about this idea, and I think you're right, that lots of people are lying, do you think it's more, is it more devastating to be lying to oneself or to lying to other people with regard to our ability to kind of face the truth down and understand what it means to us?
You know, I think it starts with self, and then, you know, goes on from there. You know, one of the things that was so sort of striking to me when I first moved to the States from Southern Africa, in general, I think Southern Africans are very outspoken and very, you know, very humorous way. But we deal with some of these issues that, yeah, just are almost taboo. I mean, I don't think we have very rigorous conversations here about race. We obviously don't. I mean, Ferguson seemed to come as a shocking surprise to a lot of people in this country. We don't have a you know, robust conversation about gender inequality. People get sort of very impatient and anxious about that. I don't think we have very robust conversations about the wars that we're engaged in and the kind of support that, you know, the men and women who fight those wars need when they come home, as well as, you know, once when they're deployed. And I think a lot of that has to do with how quickly we're moving through our world and how inconvenient it is to sit down and start asking yourself these tricky questions. In a way, a kind of lie or a white lie seems like an easy, numb, non-controversial way to get through a day. And I think that that's getting emphasized more and more and more, that we not rock the boat, that we, you know, sort of all engage in a kind of mutual numbing. And I think that that can be very dangerous. I also think that we need to learn to use our speech and this incredible gift of freedom of speech that this country gives us responsibly, so that, you know, we can say, listen, you're not, you and I aren't going to agree, but the equal and opposite gift of freedom of speech is that we learn to have the courage to begin to really hear one another, so that we can use the collective dignity of our intelligence to come to a decision, to come to a mature way to live together.
Is the hesitation that we worry that somehow this search for truth will involve, you know, exposing some culpability on our part?
I think so. I think that we're very afraid of saying, yeah, I messed up. Wow. And in fact, I messed up several times. And, you know, one of the things that I'm so startled by, when you listen, there must be no one more self-involved than me. I've written, you know, four memoirs and 46. I've done a lot of thinking about myself. And one of the hardest things to do, I mean, people would, you would assume that amount of self-involvement is easy. And actually, though, if you look around, people are doing everything they can not to be alone with themselves, not to think about their lives in full. You know, they're busy texting and they're busy listening to podcasts or the radio. Or, you know, what this requires when you sit down and write a memoir is to be silent and still with yourself for, you know, 14 hours a day, till the thing's done. And in the course of that self-examination, you find plenty, you know, of blame, of praise, or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, we're messy, we're human, and we're reactive. I mean, that really ended up fascinating me. How much was I in reaction, not just to my childhood, not just to my parents, you know, good Lord, I think there's a statute of limitations where you can get over blaming that, you know, I think that when you're about 18. But also, what things did my parents and grandparents and their parents do that set in play the person that would become me, that set in play this big romance with this larger-than-life man, that set in play this little family, that set in play this tiny drama that ended up being me, you know, and me divorced from this wonderful man? How did that happen? And it seemed to me that if you picked back the strands, it went back further than the two of us, further than our parents, deeper, older, almost as if we needed to live out the wounds and mistakes of our forefathers and foremothers, who had maybe not taken full responsibility for who they were and how they had ended up where they were.
Is it always evident to you as you're writing what belongs within a work on the page and what, for whatever reason, is maybe there is nothing too delicate to go on the page, but you are also thinking mm-hmm. about the other human beings in your life that you care about who are featured in your writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's, look, it's going to be different for everybody. But my first rule is that there be compassion, because I think that I am missing some sort of enzyme that other people have that makes them process. I'm not very private. I mean, I'll tell the person in the grocery line almost anything. And I find a great deal of freedom in that. I don't sort of find myself endlessly fascinating to that degree. Like, I don't think my privacy is something that has to be guarded. But I can see that other people feel differently about their privacy. And I try and be very aware of that, that people are entitled to their private life. That is not, that's not fair game for me. And so, particularly in this book, Charlie really is a cipher. I write him, you know, no one needs to know the horrible sordid details of every single thing I know. I mean, I had the incredible privilege of living with remarkable intimacy with this man for 20 years. It would be, I think, immoral, really, and unethical of me to take advantage of that. You know, on the other hand, and then people sort of ask, well, you know, has he read it or have your family read it? And I gave him a copy, and he was trekking to the base of Mount Everest. I think he's doing his Eat, Pray, Love right now. So I don't know if he, you know, he certainly didn't sort of communicate that he hated it or loved it or anything. That was just his usual response, which is a kind of silence, which is fair enough. And then as for my family, I mean, I think people think that your families would read your book. And actually on publication day, my sister phoned me from Zambia. So I was quite excited because that anyone in my family had even remembered, oh, it's my sister from Zambia. I answer the phone. I go, hi. And Vanessa goes, oh, hi, Al. You'll never guess what. I've got amoebic dysentery. It's awful. And so it wasn't about my book at all. And so, you know, I think from an early age, I sort of realized I'm not the most important thing at all, even to my own parents and sisters. So honestly, the rest of the world, there's a tiny little blip where maybe a couple of people know about you for 3 seconds and then it goes away. And the bigger thing is that to most people, you're essentially anonymous. You're this storyteller that comes into their life. They feel that they know you very well. They really don't. They project, I think, a lot onto you. And then the next person comes along. And so I think it's a, you know, for me, certainly as a memoirist, when I get a little bit cringy about exposing myself, I remember, you know, in the big picture, I'm a flea on the flea on the flea of a bottom of an elephant, you know. But my job is to certainly, you know, protect my children and my ex-husband. Yes, that felt critical in the context of this work.
Speaking of amoebic dysentery, which, by the way, is not, I don't think I've started a sentence that way, but perhaps you started many. but you, it's a small detail in the book, but you actually blame, you got whooping cough in Dallas when you were here a few years ago. Do you blame the city for this?
Yes, I blame. No, I don't. I don't, but I do remember the astonishing feeling of being on a rooftop of a hotel in this incredible heat, just thinking about the fact that it was, you know, the warmest place I'd been outside of Southern Africa.
And you you actually remember the person that you think you caught it from? You have no way of knowing, of course.
I have no way of knowing. No, they say actually that you will remember because it's such a distinct cough. It sounds like a seal barking. And so afterwards, when you know, start coughing like that, you sort of remember back to the person who was coughing in that way, who shall remain unnamed.
I'm glad that you have fully recovered to write more. I hope your sister's doing all right now.
Yeah. Yes. Right, yes, good. She is. Thank you. Yeah.
The new memoir by Alexandra Fuller is called Leaving Before the Rains Come. It is such a pleasure to talk to you every time we have talked. So thank you so much for making this time.
And Chris, thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it. I love this show.
Thank you so much.